Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
You're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a member of the Christians for Liberty Network. Carrie Baldwin is our guest today. She's an independent researcher and writer with a BA in philosophy from Arizona State University. She's known for her work with the Libertarian Christian Institute, the Reformed Libertarian Podcast, and her website near liberty.com. She was also a key author on the first edition of Faith Seeking Freedom, which is about to be re-released as a significantly updated and expanded edition, and you participated in those updates and expansions as well. So, yep. Carrie, welcome to the Libertarian Christian Podcast again.
Thank you, Cody, for having me. It's actually, I think the last time I was on the Libertarian Christian Podcast was when Doug was still the only host. I think This is the first time I've been on since you started hosting.
Well, I'm happy to welcome you. So this is our first one doing this. I think you're on my last podcast that I did solo, mm-hmm. which wasn't nearly as well viewed, but you know. All right, so let's talk about Freedom Fest first. So Freedom Fest is the big libertarian conference that happens every year. And this year it's taking place in Las Vegas on July 8th through 11th. And LCI is going to be there, along with all the authors of Faith Seeking Freedom, which includes you and me. But mm-hmm. but you're going to be doing more than manning the booth and signing books, right?
Yeah, I'm LCI's main event. Yeah, I'm going to be taking the main stage with an informal debate moderated by LCI's Norman Horn, as far as I'm aware. And I will be debating Dr. Michael Shermer. He is the founder and editor, I believe, of Skeptic Magazine. And he has his own podcast, I believe, called The Professional Skeptic. And so he's got a theory on abortion rights. And so we're going to debate that. Well, the resolution is a little bit different, and we can talk about that. But this will be the first time in Freedom Fest's 20-year history that the topic of abortion will be on the main stage. And so it's kind of a big deal. And one reason why we were able to achieve that was because we proposed a sort of spin on the debate by way of the resolution.
Well, that sounds intriguing. So what's the spin?
So the resolution is, if I can recall it correctly, a consistent libertarian defense of women's rights requires recognizing fetal self-ownership.
Okay.
And so what we're going to be doing is sort of granting for the sake of argument that the fetus has at least negative rights, and whether that is a benefit to women or not. And I will be arguing that it is in a legal rights perspective.
Okay, that's really interesting. Yeah, so I'm excited to hear this. So, I mean, Shermer obviously is pretty high profile. Well, assuming you know, kind of hang out in this world of kind of atheism and theism and the debates that happen, obviously he's certainly a big name in that world. And so when I was an atheist and then when I became a Christian who did a lot of apologetics, of course, you know, you see Michael Shermer all over the place. So, But, you know, he's obviously has some libertarian leanings. I know he was interviewed not too long ago by Nick Gillespie and that came out in that conversation. But this is going to be your second high profile public dialogue that I'm aware of. And the first one was also on abortion with Walter Block at the Soho Forum debates. And so how do you expect this conversation to differ from that one? So first of all, there's a resolution difference, but also there's a different person involved with different kind of a different perspective, different style. So what do you think is going to be different with this one?
Yeah, I think one of the main differences you're going to find is that I think Shermer identifies as libertarian-ish. He's not quite Mr. Libertarian that Walter Block is. And so I think he's willing to let go of certain libertarian arguments if he doesn't see that they work. And I think that he would probably say that doesn't make him not libertarian. And we can get into what his actual arguments is going to be, or at least from, you know, what I can tell from his writings. Walter Block was different because He is Mr. Libertarian. We were arguing very specifically on Rothbardian grounds. And that made for a really interesting debate because most abortion debates are not argued from the same grounds. You've got, you know, typically in the conventional debate, you've got the religious right who's arguing from a religious position, often an emotionally charged position, you know, making arguments like you should want your baby. And on the left, you have these arguments which vary greatly between we can't know if the fetus is a rights bearer or not to we know and we don't care. And so what you're going to get, I think, with Michael Shermer is I think he cares about the debate. I think he cares about all the human beings involved, but he's going to be arguing that the rights of the woman supersede the rights of the fetus.
So he may be, I mean, a little bit more slippery though in that regard, because he's not, you aren't necessarily coming from the same foundation all the time. He may be willing to kind of duck and dodge around certain libertarian implications. Yeah.
Well, he's making a personhood argument from what I understand from his writings, which is the argument that Marianne Warren made back in 1973. And I just looked this up before we got on. Marianne Warren's paper on personhood and how it related to abortion rights was published the same month that Roe v. Wade was decided. So Shermer really isn't making a new argument. I think he's probably bringing it back up because questions of personhood and consciousness and sentience are being brought back to the fore thanks to AI and those discussions.
Yeah.
But as far as I can tell, there's not much of a difference.
It's interesting to think that some on the left may start arguing that an AI is a person, but but a fetus isn't. Well, so maybe just kind of to retread the Block debate. For those who don't know, remember Block's view. It's called evictionism. And if we can maybe kind of redo that debate in, you know, 30 to 45 seconds, what was that view? What was he arguing for? And why didn't you think that it holds up?
Yeah, so Block basically granted fetal self-ownership. And he did that just as a rhetorical flourish or a rhetorical tool. And our disagreement really was over, or is over, the right to abort pre-viability. Block and I are in basic agreement post-viability. And so he takes what's known as the evictionist argument. He holds that the woman is analogous to a landlord. apartment building, a landlord, and the fetus is analogous to a tenant. And so you're either invited or disinvited. And if you're disinvited, then you're allowed to evict. So that's his argument.
Interesting. And you know, I could see where that sounds kind of reasonable. I've heard people say that before. So what's the major flaw in that viewpoint?
So there's a few arguments that I made against Block, but probably the most prominent one is the trespasser analogy is disanalogous to pregnancy. And I argue that because a trespasser is someone who crosses a boundary line in some form or another, and the fetus doesn't do that. This is the single point where every human being comes into existence. So we're talking about the emergence of new life. And that is the result, the direct result of an action taken by the mother and the father. And you can't just escape that. So there isn't actually any analogy that works for pregnancy, because pregnancy is sui generis. It's a unique situation. And actually, as such, we should be deriving normative theory from it, not trying to apply other theories to it by way of analogy.
Because it's too different. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So as I mentioned, Shermer, as we talked about, I guess, Shermer isn't the same as Block, not the same beast. What do you think his strongest argument for abortion choice is, and where do you think his weak point is?
So as I understand his argument, and I'm still learning it, to be honest, but as I understand his argument, he does argue in favor of a personhood definition for, you know, moral agency. And he translates rights, human rights, to moral agency. So this is an ethical argument. It was an argument when Marianne Warren made it, was an ethical argument. And one thing that he's done that's different from Warren is that he's assigned a fractional amount of personhood to the fetus as it develops over the course of 9 months. Marianne Warren didn't do that. And so I think what he's trying to do is make the case that you have a person or a rights-bearing person by the time the baby's born. And we can, you know, touch on why I think that's erroneous. But he's still using the same characteristics of personhood to argue for rights. So consciousness, sentience, rationality, those sorts of things.
So he might sort of say that at a six-month-old fetus could qualify for maybe 3/5 of a person and then could get representatives in the House based on that.
That's hilarious.
Okay, so
one other thing that I've learned is that he has something, he's got this idea called the moral arc. So he does believe in this, that we should be on this definition of personhood, we should be trying to expand the amount of people, the number of people that fall under the moral arc. And that's interesting because, like, he makes, it's very intentional, right? Those people who used to not be considered as rights-bearing individuals, such as women or African-Americans, you know, slaves, that sort of thing, at one time, they wouldn't have fallen under the moral arc because they didn't have recognized rights. So he believes in this expanding moral arc. The irony of that, though, I think, is that he's deliberately keeping the fetus out of that moral arc, even though he's trying very hard to make sure that every other group gets brought in.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, so, I mean, you mentioned that the pro-choicers tend to argue by analogy, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's different ones that, you know, you'll sometimes hear, many of them, I think, very scientifically illiterate, like the idea that masturbation is akin to genocide, right? Which I think this is the first time I've mentioned that in mixed company, the M word. But Or like, you know, these analogies that, like, the fetus is a trespasser, a parasite, you hear that. But as you mentioned earlier, pregnancy is sui generis. It's a unique natural relationship. Could you expand on that just a little bit?
So, you know, sui generis is this fancy Latin term that just means this is a unique situation. It doesn't have an analogy to go with it. It's the fetus is not a parasite because it's the same species as the mother, and it's not actually parasitic when you consider what a parasite actually does. It's not, and I think Shermer might argue this. Some people argue that pregnancy has a net detriment on the woman's body. There's plenty of science that argues the opposite, that there's a net positive effect. But it's not a parasite because it doesn't actually carry any of the biological markers of a parasite. It's not, and Thompson's Violinist was another one that was actually used in the defense of Roe v. Wade. Interestingly enough, this is the famous thought experiment about hooking up, you know, kidnapping somebody and hooking them up to a violinist for 9 months. And if you disconnect, then you're going to kill them, right? And so that doesn't work because, you know, nobody's kidnapped the woman. And the fetus emerges from within. The fetus hasn't taken any sort of action against the mother. And it wasn't put there by the father. There's a lot of feminists who kind of argue that a pregnancy happens simply because of the father. And so the father must have put it there. Totally ironic, because in ancient times,
right.
the Greek patriarchalists would totally have agreed with that. Yes, we put it there.
It's interesting, yeah, because it makes the man the depositor of the seed, and the woman is the land, right? And so it's interesting how many of these pro-choice arguments end up sort of making the woman not an agent, right?
Oh, not an agent, but also validating the patriarchalist arguments, which is absurd to me.
Right.
Okay. So anyways, the analogies, the analogies fail. I thought the trespass analogy was the most interesting one. I think Locke's argument is probably the most interesting pro-choice argument, because he's actually trying to do rights theory instead of just rationalizing, you know, Roe v. Wade. But I think that also fails for the reasons I mentioned. We're talking about the emergence of new life.
Yeah, correct. Well, so if you're being so concise with your answers, I'm worried we're going to get through my questions too quickly. So
but you can ask new questions, you know.
I can do it. Yeah, it's true. That's true. But obviously, you're very practiced at thinking through this. So if pregnancy is not, you know, aggression by the fetus, as some, you know, pro-choicers are going to say, but is instead this foreseeable consequence of voluntary action, does that mean that some would say that consent to sex equals consent to pregnancy?
So this is a really good question. And I would actually argue that you can consent to sex and not consent to pregnancy. I think that's totally legitimate. And the way that I have come to that conclusion is, you know, you and I were taught when we were young that a woman can get pregnant during any day of her cycle. And that's actually not true. There are only roughly 5, maybe 7 days where a woman can get pregnant during her cycle. So there's a number of days where she can't. And on top of that, there are signals that a woman can learn about her body to know whether or not she's fertile or not. And so she can actually actively choose to have sex during the time where she's not fertile and not get pregnant. And you don't need, I mean, there's many technological advances that have made that, what's known as the fertility awareness method, more accurate, but you can do it without any technology whatsoever. And so because we can, from a natural state, actually choose to have sex and plan it such that you don't get pregnant, I think you can say that you can consent to sex and not to pregnancy.
Okay, so that's interesting. So, I feel like I feel like that deserves a follow-up, but I'm not sure which one, what to ask. maybe we'll kind of allow for now that, yeah, there's going to be instances where, pregnancy is not possible, right? Mm-hmm. But what about the issue of rape? Because rape does, I think, you know, change the thing here, because we're not talking about voluntary action at all. Do you think that rape changes the mother unborn child relationship in a meaningful enough way that it could justify abortion? Because if we're sort of saying, well, you know, you did the crime, you do the time or whatever, and so, you know, abortion's not on the table for you. I mean, it sounds kind of crude the way I put it, but like, it sounds kind of reasonable. But once you're talking about the fact that sometimes pregnancy occurs because without the consent of the woman at all, doesn't that change the dynamic a little bit? Does that justify abortion?
So no, and I'll explain why. First of all, if we take the consensual situation, a woman consenting to sex can withhold her consent for pregnancy. But the issue isn't, have I consented to pregnancy? Any infertile woman would tell you if it was a matter of, if her, you know, having a child was a matter of her consenting to pregnancy, then infertility wouldn't be the issue. So consent really isn't an issue in whether you get pregnant or not. What pregnancy is the natural consequence of the action taken to have sex, right? So, and we, you know, in libertarian terms, we can say you're free to choose, but you're not free from the consequences of your choices. And these are natural consequences. They aren't consequences that are put on you by somebody else. Now, in the case of rape, that's different. Because in the case of rape, you haven't consented to the sex. If you get pregnant, obviously you haven't consented to the pregnancy, but that means that you are now, the use of your body has been hijacked by someone. And the pro-choice argument is that someone who's hijacked your body is the baby. And that seems to be the most logical answer, because that's the most imminent person involved. But the reality is, what I argue is that the person really who's hijacked your body is the rapist. And this is really an important part of the debate, because in our legal system, we have laws on violent crimes, and some violent crimes are defined by aggression, such as murder or theft. But then you have rape, and rape is not defined by aggression in the vast majority of states. Some states have redefined it by way of consent. We can talk about how that's been a problem or how that poses a problem. But in most states, it's defined by degree of harm. And when it's defined by degree of harm, that puts the woman or the victim, the rape victim, on trial. And that's a really bad place to be, because now the woman is having to prove that she was harmed enough to get a conviction. And so what we've done in our judicial system is we've said, okay, women are not actually able to prove that in every case of sexual assault and rape. And so what we are going to offer instead of actually fixing the definition and defining it by aggression, we're going to offer her abortion. And so one of the things that I'm arguing is that when we recognize the rights of the fetus, and the rape case is a perfect example of how this bears itself out, what we find is not, oh, now we need a justification for abortion, or more specifically, we need to justify violence against an otherwise innocent party in order to solve the problem. What we need to do is actually look at the criminal justice system and say, hey, wait a minute, we have not properly defined this. So when it comes to what I would call a pro-life libertarian argument on rape, is that you have two victims, right? You've got the woman, you've got the fetus, both are victims. And you cannot use violence against the second victim in order to solve that problem, because now that second victim has been victimized twice. Instead, what you have is a situation where the woman, she's already obligated to not aggress against the fetus. The flip side of that question is she obligated to provide life support? In the case of consensual sex, I argue that she is. In the case of rape, what I argue is that technically she is not, but because she cannot aggress against the fetus, she is an unwilling participant in the life support. And that is actually part of the tort restitution against the rapist. So the rapist should be actually on the hook, not just for the crime against the woman, not just for the crime against the fetus, but part of that crime against the woman is effectively enslaving her body for at least 9 months, if not longer, if she chooses to keep the child.
Well, and I think that the reason why this kind of pro-choice argument seems reasonable is you can imagine sort of saying, well, the woman has been, you know, aggressed upon once, right? Something has happened to her body without her permission, and she doesn't want to be pregnant, and now she is. And so, you know, the pro-choicer is going to say, so now you're telling her she has to be pregnant for 9 months. And but your retort there that, well, if the solution to this problem is we're going to aggress upon another human being who's done nothing wrong, that doesn't seem like the right response. And I think that's very weighty. So when you bring up tort, those who may not be familiar with some of these legal terms, we're talking about sort of damages, right? That the person who's aggressed upon her is not the child, it's the rapist. And so the rapist is the one who should be held accountable and should try to be the one who needs to be making restitution in this situation.
Yeah. So I think it's fine to grant that a pregnancy from rape is is making the woman participate in something that she doesn't want to participate in. The pro-choice argument is that either the fetus is forcing her or the state is forcing her if the state is, you know, conventionally pro-life. But this, and I argued this, or I guess I didn't argue this, but I brought it up in my debate with Block. What this does is that it actually lets the rapist off the hook, because then the focus becomes, you know, the baby, which can't actually take action against you, can't be considered an aggressor, can't be considered a criminal in this case, or the state. And the state is supposed to be there to uphold the rights of individual people, right? And if you focus on those two elements, what you're doing is you're saying, forget the rapist, forget what the rapist did, forget about what that means as far as payment for his crime, right? Just forget all of that. Because the solution is clearly just let her off the hook for having the baby. And that letting her off the hook for having the baby, number one, is a violent solution to a nonviolent problem, which is the existence of the baby itself, right? The existence of the baby is not violence itself. It was the act that created it that's violence. And number two, any libertarian would agree that violence is not the solution to nonviolent problems. And yet here we are with this problem where we're proposing violence as the solution. So it really should redirect back to the rapist and put a spotlight back on him and what that means as far as restitution for his crime.
Yeah, well, and I think like so many of these conversations we have about abortion, it really goes back to the question of whether the unborn is a rights-bearing individual. Because if they are, then you can't aggress upon them. And if they're not, then do whatever you want, right? And so you don't need some kind of special justification for it. If they're not a rights-bearing individual, do what you want. If they are, then you have to treat them as such. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, this is a libertarian Christian podcast, and so we can talk about markets a little bit. You know, do free markets, would they naturally reduce abortion demand? And what are the most promising market-based innovations you think could emerge in a deregulated environment?
Yeah, so this is probably one of the most distinct aspects of what I call pro-life libertarianism. Although, to be clear, my argument is that libertarianism is necessarily pro-life. But the unique thing about this argument that's different from the conventional debate is that the conventional pro-life side actually believes that if they outlaw abortion, if they legally outlaw abortion in whatever form they imagine, whether it's the abolitionist who's, you know, charging the woman herself with crimes, or it's the incrementalist who is banning, you know, abortion procedures and drugs. Both of them believe that what's going to end the practice of abortion is the legal aspect. I don't believe that's the case. I believe that what is going to actually end the practice of abortion is market solutions. And actually, Shermer and I agree on this point. And the reason why I believe that is because we've gotten to the point with abortion technology, specifically medication abortion, that what you need to do in order to end the practice of abortion is to get that woman who's staring herself down in her mirror, holding that pill in her hand, going, should I do this? What you're trying to get her to do is voluntarily throw it away, right? Because if you have the conventional pro-life side, you've got, you know, a SWAT team behind her front door banging it down in order to try to stop her from swallowing the pill, right? And in the pro-choice schema, you've got them cheering her on despite whatever complications may arise from actually taking that pill. And neither of those, both of those situations are not good for the woman. So you have to get her to a place where she feels like she doesn't actually have to take that solution. And the only way you're going to do that is through the market. And when we talk about market innovations, I mean, Block talks about you know, the innovation of artificial womb technology. And it's an interesting technology. I'm not sure that you're ever going to actually get it to the point where, you know, you find out that you're, you know, 4 weeks pregnant already or 6 weeks pregnant already, and you don't want to have that baby and you want to transfer it out. Like, we don't have that level of technology yet as far as artificial womb technology is concerned. You can only transfer them at the point of viability. And I don't think that we're going to get there, quite frankly. We could, but I don't think artificial womb technology is the main innovation that we're waiting for. Market innovations include things that involve very practical things that a woman needs, right? This means getting rid of the ACA, right? Socialized healthcare, which has skyrocketed the cost of pregnancy, just pregnancy. Right now, the average cost of pregnancy is between $18,000 and $20,000 out of pocket. Whereas a free market could easily get that down to about $2,000, $3,000, maybe $4,000. Before insurance companies started insuring pregnancy, pregnancy was actually quite affordable. Once you introduced insurance companies and then introduced regulations, it jacked up the price. So we need to bring down the cost of pregnancy. And one way you do that is through the market. We need to bring down the cost of food, right? The cost of education, the cost of all these, the cost of being a mother is what needs to be brought down. And the only way that that can happen is through the free market.
Well, yeah, you could add the cost of being a human being has gone up significantly because of government intervention.
Yes. Well,
so let's talk about positive duties. So, no. Positive obligations are sometimes one of sometimes libertarians will speak of those as kind of in a negative way that, you know, we don't really have obligations to each other. We have, you know, negative rights, negative, you know, that sort of just defines what our obligations are. And this has also come into discussion with this issue of parenting, right? And so some libertarian theorists, I think even Rothbard kind of dabbled in this a little bit. He was like, okay, so what does it mean? Do parents actually have a responsibility to their children? And he was like, probably not, right? Like, yeah. And so this has been, I think, an issue that libertarians have sometimes struggled to think about because parenting is a positive obligation. It's a positive duty. Mm-hmm. And so how do you square that with libertarianism when some libertarians tend to reject that idea?
Yeah, so the first thing I would say is that serious libertarians are actually not opposed to the idea of positive obligation or positive duty, and I'll get to that in a second. What they are opposed to, and I think rightly opposed to, is the idea of positive rights. And positive rights are these creations by the state that says that in order for this person's right to be protected, this other person owes them something, right? So if you talk about the right to healthcare, you know, that sounds all great if you're the recipient of that. But in order to provide a right to healthcare, you have to force the doctor to provide a service to that person against their will, effectively. And so that's the thing that libertarians are opposed to, and I think rightly opposed to. Okay. So when I think, you know, of Rothbard and the fact that, you know, he had this really wackadoo idea of parental obligation that you could literally let them starve or leave them exposed and you weren't violating any rights. That intuitively is wrong to people, but people can't explain why for the most part. The way I've conceived it is, you know, we go back to the fact that the mother's and father's actions have the consequence of pregnancy, right? Part of that consequence is not just that the woman's body is occupied now. Part of that consequence is you have brought into existence a new rights bearer who, just by the necessity of nature, is in a position where it cannot provide for itself, and it was brought into existence against its will. None of us came into existence because we wanted to. All of us come into existence against our will. And so what this creates is a proprietary interest that the fetus has in the parents. And that proprietary interest is for life support, basically. And I've kept it at life support because that's really all that you get in pregnancy. You get shelter and food, effectively. And, you know, one thing that I think Rothbard and other libertarians are trying to avoid is this idea of obligating the parents to what's in the best interest of the children, because that's super subjective and anything can be in the best interest of the children. And the state certainly uses that as an excuse to require all kinds of things that may not actually be in the best interest of the children, right? So I wouldn't even say that, I would say education is in the best interest of your child, but it's not an enforceable duty. It's not a natural duty that is the result of pregnancy. Now, you obviously want your kids to become successful adults, and so now you have an incentive to educate your kids, but that's a separate question. The one other thing I'll say before you respond is I think that this argument about proprietary interest in the parents is actually the argument that libertarians need in order to make the case against positive rights. Because we are not the state's children. We're not their offspring. We don't hold a proprietary interest in them. They don't have a positive, you know, they don't have this proprietary obligation to us. That connection doesn't exist, and we can ground that in the parent-fetal relationship.
No, that's interesting. Well, so just kind of thinking through this practically, under normal circumstances, you know, if I had a child that I decided I didn't want, I would still be responsible for taking care of their needs. So that would mean I can't just drop them off on the street. I have to sort of make sure that they're in a position to be taken care of. Now, and I think we could apply that to a mother as well. And I mean, obviously, but when we get into the rape argument, I guess what I would wonder there is, you know, presumably there's still some kind of an obligation that the mother has, but is the obligation not extend as far as the father's obligation? So for example, a mother can't kill the baby that's in their womb, but if it was conceived without their permission, would the primary responsibility for that child's care, that whatever financial needs or whatever, would that primarily fall on the rapist, the father, or just that, is there still a proprietary obligation that the mother would have, do you think?
So I would say that the obligation as far as literal cost falls on the father. There is still a proprietary interest created in the woman as far as, you know, the baby is her genetic offspring. And so if she wants to keep the child, she has the highest claim to do so. But she's not obligated to do so. The only thing that she's obligated to is to not aggress against the fetus and to provide that necessary life support. And the cost for that necessary life support gets passed on to the rapist. So she should be given restitution for that. And if she chose, I think that the child is actually entitled to restitution for child support, quite frankly. I call rape the first act of child abuse, which incidentally decouples the parental right, the corresponding parental right that the rapist would have if that had been a consensual act. So he forfeits his rights as a parent, but he takes on the obligations that would normally be distributed between both the man and the woman. He takes on those obligations. She is obligated to find suitable life support after the baby's born, so adoption in some form, and the rapist is on the hook for the cost to do all of that.
That makes total sense.
Yeah. If she chose to keep the baby, which she would have the right to do, she could demand ongoing child support for raising the baby, you know, for raising that child.
Or waive that if she chose to.
Yeah, she could waive that if she chose to. Yeah.
Well, so anybody who maybe hasn't been listening for the last 40 minutes and says, you just hate women. how do you think your framework avoids this common pro-choice critique that maybe in some cases is valid, because some maybe that might be true of some you know, kind of right-wing pro-life evangelicals or whatever. But this idea that pro-lifers are just reducing women to incubators. How do you think that your critiques or your framework gets around those critiques?
Well, I think I think what libertarianism does is it recognizes the self-ownership and agency of women. This is incontestable, right? I don't think that you could have a libertarian argument that doesn't take seriously the self-ownership and agency of women. And so when I talk about abortion, I talk about it as a canary in the coal mine issue. And basically the canary is a signal of a potentially toxic environment, right? And so if we actually take the woman seriously and listen to her reasons for why she needs abortion, rape, poverty, financial hardship, bad relationships, right? It's, you know, those sorts of reasons. We should be listening to those reasons as market signals or signals that there's something wrong with our judicial processes. And instead, what we're given is we're given the right to abort, and that is in lieu of actually making changes to the economy, actually making changes to the judicial system, actually making changes to educating women about toxic relationships and things like that. And so I refer to abortion as crumbs from the table of justice. It is actually the pro-choice view, and even the conventional pro-life view, I do agree, is anti-woman, because it doesn't counter any of those reasons. It doesn't say, yeah, let's go fix the economy. It says, it's not as expensive as you're making it out to be. It's total, like, the right totally gaslights women, and it ticks me off. You know, it's not, oh, you know, I understand that, you know, you're not ready to actually use your body to birth a baby. You know, let's figure this out. It's, oh, you should want your baby. Like it's minimizing a woman's actual view of the world, her agency as far as what she gets to do with her body or not. And I think that what libertarianism does is it properly recognizes the bodily autonomy and her agency without saying we're going to resort to violence to solve this problem.
Hmm. That's interesting. Before I ask my next question, it just occurred to me that we could be giving Michael Shermer a lot of ammunition for his debate because he's maybe studying your responses. But if he's listening right now, let's just say, hi, Mike.
Hi, Michael. I'm not afraid.
So I mean, here's, I think this is the one that always makes me a little bit nervous when I listen to some on the right who take that sort of pro-life or what they call the abolitionist viewpoint or whatever, that they're going to go back to this idea that women should be punished by law for having abortions, that the target of a governmental response needs to be the, you know, retribution against women. Where do you stand on that as a libertarian Christian?
Yeah, so this is a really important question, because I think what happens, especially from the pro-choice side, is they look at our current situation and they say, okay, if I can't have an abortion, then X, Y, and Z things are going to happen. And they're not necessarily wrong, right? Black market abortion, I think, is totally plausible. In fact, in New Mexico right now, they passed a law. We've got in New Mexico, you can get abortion up to birth. And they just passed a law that stopped recording data of who's getting abortions and for what reasons. So now we're not tracking the number of abortions in the state of New Mexico. They do that under privacy concerns, but now we don't know how many of those women are having complications from abortion, how many of those women came from out of state. Like, the idea of black market abortions or eschewing the medical responsibility towards women goes out the window, right? Another aspect is the enforcement aspect. And I think that this is really quite important, because what they are opposed to is an authoritarian enforcement of abortion prohibition. And you know, I will never forget Scott Klusendorf of the Pro-Life Training Institute saying that a war on abortion will look like a war on drugs. And every libertarian knows what that means.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, if that's the deal, then no go. Yeah. Like,
is he saying that the CIA is going to start flying in abortions from Nicaragua? Sorry, go ahead.
You know, I think libertarians are not only arguing for the rights, the legal rights side of the argument, we're also arguing for the legal enforcement side of the argument. And there is a libertarian enforcement and there is an authoritarian enforcement. And the authoritarian enforcement, hands down, 100% I'm opposed to. I think it is inherently unjust. I don't think Christians should support it. I don't think libertarians should support it. I don't think that pro-lifers should support it. When we're talking about libertarian enforcement, we're talking about protecting the rights of the accused, right? We're talking about the actual standards of evidence. We're talking about, I think that we should actually bring back the concept of mens rea, which is criminal intent. But the other thing that I think we need to look at is the actual criminal justice system. Most women do not get abortions with mens rea. They get it because they are in a desperate situation. They can't afford the baby, or they're in a bad relationship they can't get out of, or things like that. In which case, there are other remedies that we can leverage that doesn't have to be retributive justice, which is throw the book at her and throw her in prison.
Well, yeah. Well, and I think you've got a point about this, because, you know, when Roe v. Wade went out, it seemed that, you know, I, as a pro-lifer, I should have been sort of excited about the possibilities, but I had a lot of anxiety about what that was going to actually look like, what was going to really change on the state level. And, you know, pro-choicers made an argument that I think libertarians in particular should be sympathetic to, which is if we get the state involved in punishing abortion, every miscarriage is going to be treated as a crime scene and every period is going to be tracked by local police departments. And it just becomes this kind of horrible bureaucratic mess. And like you said, you know, worse than the drug war. And so, I mean, so it seems that you're sympathetic to that argument. You had concerns about that happening as well.
Oh, yeah. You know, the surveillance state. The idea that a woman could be strip searched on the side of the road, right? That's enough for me to be like, hold up, wait a minute. Miscarriage, by the way, if we are using the principles of self-ownership and non-aggression to define crime, miscarriage does not fall under it because it is not an act of aggression, plain and simple. And, you know, we can recognize the difference between an abortion and a miscarriage for the most part.
I agree with that. I think the criticism was though, that just as, you know, today, if my wife was to kill me, there would be an investigation. Mm-hmm. Was it an accidental homicide or was it right? And so does that end up happening with abortion once we get the state involved in it? Right.
Yeah. So I think, well, when we talk about the state, you know, we're talking about two different things because we're talking about an authoritarian monopoly, right? Which is where all of this stuff like the war on drugs and crap comes up, right? And where you have people like abolitionists who are the most militant in their views of women who get abortions, like they are leveraging a degree of power that a libertarian government doesn't have. Okay, so that's number one. We're talking about a state monopoly. The second thing that we're talking about is civil governance as such. What they have monopolized is civil governance. And so, you know, if abortion is categorical murder, right? It's an act of aggression against a rights-bearing individual that ends their life. Then it has to fall under the jurisdiction of civil governance. The problem that we're faced with is we have a monopolization of civil governance that is authoritarian. And so, you know, I think in situations where, let's say you have legislation going up before your state legislature, right? Let's say the abolitionists have submitted legislation, right? A pro-life libertarian could look at that legislation and argue either against it because it is an authoritarian enforcement, or they can argue to amend it so that it is more libertarian. But the answer isn't keep it out of civil governance totally. The answer is we need to change our government, which we already know, but now we have an incentive to do that.
Well, and maybe I want to put a kind of a finer point on this, what this alternative system might look like. And so, you know, you're arguing that abortion can be addressed without a centralized enforcer of justice, without a monopoly. And to put a finer point on that, my understanding is you're taking an anarcho-capitalist view where you have a system of polycentric law. And in that system, justice comes from private service providers. And that could, I think you're arguing, protect the rights of the unborn in a better way. And so I'll be honest with you on this. I have some doubts that private courts and police could provide impartial justice, especially for those who Jesus called the least of these, babies and children, since they're not going to be customers, right? So if a child or an unborn baby isn't paying a private firm for doing this, then presumably they're going to side with the mother who wants to get the abortion who is paying them. And so why am I wrong about that? And why do you think that, or maybe how do you think that polycentric law could address abortion in a better way than some of these more conservative pro-life proposals would?
Well, I think you're operating on a false presumption, which is that women who get abortions want to be free of a baby. One of the pro-life organizations that I really admire and promote is an organization called Let Them Live. And Let Them Live seeks out abortive women who don't actually want to have an abortion. They are desperate for actual help. They need legitimate financial help if they're going to keep their baby or babies. They've saved, you know, multiples before. But what they find repeatedly, and I think you could say this for easily 99% of their clientele, is that the woman who is potentially abortive is not, I want to get rid of my baby. It's, I don't know what else to do. And so in a polycentric legal order where the market is providing multiple solutions, right? This whole idea of pro-life starts way before the woman ever gets pregnant, okay? Because the market is providing both solutions to prevent unwanted pregnancy, and it is also providing solutions for providing for unwanted pregnancies when they occur, or crisis pregnancies when they occur, right? So you've got this dynamic in the market system that would already exist that is there to help her. And also in polycentric law, the woman plays a much more active component than in monopolized civil governance. In monopolized civil governance, you typically have the people who are in a position to be able to be, you know, statesmen and legislators and governors and things like that aren't women. They are predominantly men. And so women have far less of a say in a state monopoly on government than they do in polycentric law, because that's part of the market system. And she is part of the market system. In fact, she's an integral part of the market system. And I firmly believe that the vast majority of women who get pregnant with unwanted pregnancies don't actually want to have the abortion. They want to find a more life-affirming solution, even if it's not keeping the child herself.
Okay, fair enough. So we've talked about kind of state approaches in general, but maybe just as we've got a few more minutes left here, I'll ask one kind of more specific question, then we'll go a little more general. So personhood laws, you take issue with personhood laws. So if you were to talk to a pro-life conservative who thinks these are really important for saving babies, what would you say is the problem with these personhood laws?
You never want to give the state the power to define personhood, because even if their initial definition is correct, you've just handed them the power to amend that definition. And it will be amended at some point, because when you have a monopoly on civil governance, there is an incentive to maintain that power. And when you run into situations where you can't imagine what the solution is, like with abortion, you default to injustice of various kinds, right? And, you know, slavery is a really good example of that. Slavery was used in part for economic opportunity. I just had a student who did a research paper on slavery in the United States and in Europe. And actually, one of the driving factors to abolishing slavery was that the innovation of technology made it cost prohibitive to keep slaves. And so there was actually an economic incentive at one point to get rid of slavery and just pay wages. So there's such a benefit to the problem-solving power of the market that it doesn't make sense to leave that in the hands of the state.
Okay. Well, so we'll do kind of a wrap-up. So we're going to be at Freedom Fest here in July. And let's say that someone recognizes you on an elevator and says, oh, you're the pro-life libertarian person. Give me your elevator pitch. Tell me in just a sentence or two or three. How do you defend the pro-life position from a libertarian vantage point?
Okay. So my elevator pitch would go something like this. Recognizing fetal rights formalizes women's rights. And we can finally say goodbye to an era where women and children are secondary to the whims of powerful men whose reputations are too big to fail.
Ooh, I like that. Okay, awesome. Yeah. Well, I think that's a nice preview, because as you said, that the focus of this discussion is going to be on women's rights and how that factors in. So, well, and that's something we talked about a little bit, but I'm really interested in hearing the positive take, the positive presentation that you're going to have there. And so I'm excited for this event. So remember which day it is? I know the Freedom Fest is Vegas, July 8th through 11th. Do we have it on the calendar specifically what day that's going to be?
I have been told that it will be either the 9th or the 10th, but I don't think that they've settled on a date yet. So the detailed schedule is supposed to come out early June, and that's when we know. But I've been promised either Thursday or Friday.
Okay. Well, folks should get their tickets to Freedom Fest to meet the Libertarian Christian Institute folks and our main event, Kerry Baldwin. Just Kerry Baldwin, that's the main event. And Kerry, I want to thank you for taking the time to do this. And, you know, we haven't met in person, but as we were texting back and forth, I'm going to see you in person two times over the next couple months, because I'm going to see you at Freedom Fest and I'm going to see you in June. We're recording this at the end of May at the, at Acton University. So really excited to meet you and talk to you a little bit more about this. And yeah, this is going to be a great, great debate or conversation that you're going to have.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. Yep. Well, I'll wrap it up now and just say thanks for being here. And like you said, you haven't been here in the Libertarian Christian podcast in a while, so we'll have to find a good excuse to bring you back. Thank you, Kerry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.